listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Generation Gaza by Janine DiGiovanni with photos by Fatima Speer. Next photo, Green Dreams. Asil al-Najjar and Nadine Ruck, part of an all-female farming collective in Kuzaa. That sense of one step forward, two steps back is ever present. Abdullah Abu Halima, 33, is a farmer in Beit Lahia on the northern tip of Gaza, whose life was altered forever last May. Armed with a degree in information systems from Al-Azhar University, he had a dream to grow more diverse crops in Gaza, regardless of the impediments, such as limited water and the dwindling availability of usable farmland. Studying alternative farming methods, including successful Israeli ones, Abu Halima borrowed $120,000 in 2020 to buy 48 solar panels and install 8,200 meters of hydroponic pipes. It was a big project and a big risk, but he reckoned that by using an innovative solar-powered irrigation system, he could maximize water usage, plant several different crops, and make seasonal organic vegetables available all year. Over time, Abu Halima explained, he would be able to harvest six crops instead of three, using less farmland. On an area of 3,700 square meters, he said, I could grow lettuce, broccoli, beans, parsley, green onions, and other vegetables. The bombing began on May 10th. On May 19th, Abu Halima rose early and decided he was going to sneak onto my own farm and check the plants. He found the farm leveled, the solar panels shattered. Many of the pipes he had imported for irrigation, he recalled, looked like blackened bones. Over the course of a week, his vision of several years of research and hard work had been obliterated. Everything, the greenhouses, the cooling room, they left nothing to work on. One senior UN official based in Gaza told me, every time we build a school or fix a water supply station, it gets bombed again. You begin to feel everything is pointless. Abu Halima's farm cannot be easily restored. I owe about $20,000 to people, he calculated. There's no electricity, no NGOs helping me, no regular income. He and his brother, to support their families, went to work on a local farm doing handyman chores. If he could get his own fields back, he said, he'd hire more workers, expand the operation, and export these products to the rest of the world. But now all he is left with are row upon skeletal row of broken pipes and a dashed pipe dream. I placed a call to Youssef Al-Jamal, 32, a Palestinian academic now in exile in Turkey. One night 10 years ago, he stayed up past midnight reading an alarming United Nations report. The study contended that the year 2020 would be 0 hour in the Gaza Strip, a time when the place would become completely unlivable. The slow-motion de-development that Roy had described was especially evident in dwindling health care. Employment, power, and fresh water. Only about 5% of the water supply is potable. With unemployment climbing, fragile infrastructure and electricity only available 2 to 4 hours a day at the time, now 13 hours on average, Gaza was swiftly deteriorating. Al-Jamal's story is not unique. He grew up in Gaza's Nusayrat refugee camp near the Mediterranean coast with a close family, 5 brothers, 7 sisters. His memories of childhood often pivot around conflict and deprivation, street fighting, Israeli military incursions, power blackouts, and water shortages, as well as senseless tragedies. His eldest brother, Omar, was 17 when he was killed in 2004 by an Israeli sniper. His eldest sister, Zainab, a teacher, was 26 when Israeli authorities denied her an exit permit for a simple medical procedure. She died shortly after. Al-Jamal decided academia would be his salvation. He passed rigorous exams to get into a university, taught himself languages, and worked as a translator for the UN and various publishing houses. The day after he read the UN report, he began to prepare a workshop for 100 people to discuss the implications. "I was hoping this would be a wake-up call to the international community," he said. "I thought some people would care." But only one person came to his seminar. "The sad reality," he insisted, "is people get used to the life in Gaza. They never saw the outside beyond the strip. They get used to living in crowded places with no human rights. They get used to living under siege. They don't accept it, but they live with it." In his way, he was echoing the fatalistic adage from Fyodor Dostoevsky's novel, The House of the Dead. "Man is a creature that can get accustomed to anything, and I think that is the best definition of him." Al-Jamal immigrated in 2016. "I had this absolute feeling there was no light at the end of the tunnel, economically, politically," he noted. "I saw things escalating in a bad way, day by day." Today, he is finishing his PhD in political science in Istanbul, one of 25,000 Palestinians, mainly Gazans, who have made their way to Turkey. While he enjoys freedom of movement, something he never had before, he fluctuates between his personal quest for a better life and a nagging sense of survivor's guilt. Like other expat Palestinian intellectuals before him, Edward Said Rashid Khalidi among them, he has a profound longing for his family and homeland. It is a legacy that began with a 1948 Nakba, or catastrophe, when Palestinians were expelled from their land following the Israeli War of Independence, up through the present-day Israeli occupation. Al-Jamal remarked with a heavy heart, "You leave Gaza, but Gaza doesn't leave you." The difference with this generation is the Internet. It has helped open up a new, previously inaccessible world. Gaza Sky Geeks, GSG, as in The Sky's the Limit, came into being in 2011 as a Mercy Corps program founded in partnership with Google. The loose group of compatriots run coding camps out of a small warren of offices in downtown Gaza. The Sky Geeks workspaces are named after cities its members may never get a chance to visit: Berlin, Barcelona, New York, Paris. Their goal is to propel the Gaza Strip's digital economy and train future tech leaders. They are seriously impressive. More than half the geeks are female. Most freelancers who have trained here have gotten jobs online. Collectively, the alumni from their freelance academy have earned nearly $5 million. I paid my first visit to GSG in 2019. On this trip, the pandemic has reduced the workforce to a skeleton staff. I had an early morning meeting with Asma El-Khaldi, a 25-year-old video storyteller who was already at her desk, chic in a bright pink shirt, pearl jewelry, and a pale pink silk hijab. Comfortable with a video camera since she was a teenager, she comes from the educated classes of Gaza. Her father has a law PhD, Her mother is a scientist who runs a lab. She's one of six children, all of whom speak Arabic and English. I started my first year at the UNRWA school, she told me, referring to the UN-run nonprofit that assists and advocates for Palestinian refugees. I knew it was a gateway to the world. Along with her twin sister, Saja, an architect, she launched a YouTube channel, and during the May bombings, she was sought out by international journalists to provide on-the-ground reports. We tell stories of resilience, she said, but we are trying to own our voice, own the narrative. She doesn't want Palestinians to be seen as victims, or as terrorists, a frequent depiction in the foreign media. Her videos, instead, are about Palestinian culture, heritage, history. A writers' collective in Gaza, We Are Not Numbers, was founded for precisely the same reason, to share tales of Palestinians as individuals, falling in love, navigating family dynamics, experiencing life as young people, not as people to be pitied. At times during my visit, I heard Gazans express their concerns about Israelis in general, as well as the media, for branding Palestinians en masse as terrorists. And while many Israelis are deeply disturbed by the plight of Palestinians in the Strip, there are others who regard Gaza first and foremost as a security threat. Certain factions of the Israeli public don't see Palestinians as human, explained Sarah Roy. They see them as a nuisance. I think most Israelis wish they would just disappear so they can pursue their own agenda. Through this lens, Gaza is deemed a humanitarian problem that needs to be managed, Roy stressed, not solved. Gaza is a bone in our throats, one senior government official admitted to me from his office in Jerusalem. He was friendly, polite, and articulate, but firm. We can't swallow it, and we can't spit it out. It's there, and it's choking us. Danny Rahamimim, 67, lives in Nahal Az, an Israeli kibbutz situated 800 yards from the Gaza Strip, not far from the fields being cultivated by the Green Girls. His was among the first such Jewish enclaves, established in 1951. Rahamim served in the Israeli army and settled in Nahal Az in 1975 to raise his three children. He recounted pleasant memories of going into Gaza every day. There was a direct bus line between Beersheba and Gaza City, often meeting with Palestinian friends, five of whom would later attend his wedding. In 1983, the uprisings, however, put an end to that. After the first intifada, we stopped going to Gaza, he said. Once the 1993 peace accord was signed, he went back with a group of Israelis. A short, wonderful trip, but that peace didn't last very long. In 2001, the first Hamas rocket hit the kibbutz, and since then, we've been in circles. In May, Rahamim and his family spent the 11-day war in an underground shelter. Gazans, on the other side of the fence, have no official shelters and nowhere to hide. Most of his other kibbutzniks fled to the north, according to Rahamim, but he and his family were determined to stay. When I asked him why, he had a long explanation that despite longing for peace, he was a member of the Israeli organization Peace Now. He felt compelled to assert his right as a Zionist to what he considered his homeland. I hope one day they understand that we will never leave our place, he said. When they realize this, they will agree to come and make peace or a ceasefire. Nonetheless, he is worried for Israel's future prospects as a democracy. Israel is being called an apartheid state. When people tell me this, I say that Israel is a sick democracy. You can't say that you are a democracy when so many millions of people have no human rights. We must finish the occupation. On summer and autumn evenings, when the heat subsides, Many Gazans head to the seashore. The beaches in Gaza are glorious, and I have often thought, ruefully, of the tourist opportunities that could take root here. Families flock to the beach, set up tents, stoke their barbecues, make tea, greet old friends. Some stay overnight, so the children can go to swimming lessons at 5 or 6 in the morning. I often wake up early in Gaza to see this surreal but cheering scene. Parents making breakfast while scores of kids dot the shoreline, learning to swim. The fishing boats head out to sea as the sun glints on the surf. Thursday nights mark the start of the weekend, and in Gaza towns they are often joyous. One Thursday, I went to see Osprey V, a rock band started by 5 friends and relatives who practice and perform in a studio above an electrical store owned by one of the members' fathers. I had come to this studio on past trips, and it has never ceased to amaze me because it seems to be one of the few spots in Gaza where the purely whimsical is allowed to flourish. In a nondescript building on a broken-down Gaza street, Raji El Jarou, 29, has created a musical fantasy of pianos, Dean and Martin guitars, speakers, ouds, synthesizers, keyboards. It's like an oasis where wannabe rock stars can come, pick up an instrument, and pretend to be a Palestinian Jimmy Page. Every time I'm depressed, I come here and I immediately feel better, one unemployed young Gazan told me, sitting happily in front of a drum kit. El Jarou, who started listening to Metallica as a child, put together Osprey V in 2019, and the makeup of the band is a microcosm of Gaza. 2 members are lawyers, 1 a sound engineer, 1 a sales manager, another a humanitarian worker. The night I popped in, they played acoustic sets and heavy metal, their own compositions, plus tributes to Linkin Park and Pink Floyd. They sang in New York-accented English. Yet they are sealed in their geographic bubble, yearning for camaraderie, for support, for the chance to play gigs anywhere other than Gaza. Their inspiration comes from everyday life, but also from their inner angst. Their lyrics are wrenching, exploring the desire to move from hate and oppression to freedom. Destroy every brick of every wall. Dig deep inside throughout my soul. We'll scream our pain. Can you hear the call? Knock, knock, are you listening at all? Conquer every corner on this earth. Bullets rain down, seize us all. Release the hate. In flames we'll crawl. Knock, knock, are you listening at all? This land is my home. This world is my home. This universe is my home. Every broken dream, every broken heart is home, sweet home. In 2014, during the last war, El Jarou remembered, I saw a father shielding his son against bullets. Rock music is the real way to illustrate the destruction of Gaza. There are love songs, emo songs of alienation, but also songs about beloveds being killed. It's a global message, he said. In other studios, I met with young artists in other disciplines who were experiencing a similar plight. At the Shababek Art Center, sculptors who were teenagers during the first Intifada used the materials from the war, broken concrete, splintered wood. They all share the same desire to travel to meet other artists, to exhibit their work, to have a live audience. One afternoon, I sat in on rehearsals with a talented young theater troupe, Theater Day Productions, as they practiced for a TEDx performance. The budding actors described dealing with the lack of electricity and supplies. Ahmed Al-Aidi, 26, who has been acting with the group since the 2014 war, observed, In Gaza, everything around us changes. We have no control. But when we act with theater, we can change things because we control it. Late at night, on my last day, I went to see my friend, Mousab Abu Taha, a poet who just finished a year as a distinguished guest at Harvard and has been trying unsuccessfully to get a visa so he can accept a job as an MFA teaching assistant at Syracuse. Like most of the people I spoke with, he grew up in a refugee camp. His first love? Books. In books, he said, he found an escape from the violence and sadness outside his house. 7 years ago, after an intense bombing raid that shook Gaza to its core, he decided to found the Edward Said Libraries in Gaza, named after his hero, the writer and public intellectual. The Said Libraries hold more than 2,000 books in two locations, places for children and adults to read, become computer literate, and get music lessons. One Thursday night, Abu Taha and I sat in an ice cream parlor in downtown Gaza City, a shop packed with families eating the proprietor's famous lemon ice. The scene in front of us felt almost Dickensian. Donkeys pulling carts of melons and peaches, cigarette vendors haggling with groups of men, teenage girls in hijabs laughing and walking jauntily, unescorted. The city was alive and vibrant, with little hint of the occupation. I departed the next morning, crossing through Erez after daybreak, feeling the usual tug whenever I leave Gaza. Relief to be safe, saddened by the powerlessness of so many who remain. I recalled the words of Yusuf Al-Jamal, the student in Turkey, who had relayed his own mixed emotions upon leaving. I grew up in a refugee camp, but I loved my camp. It made me what I am. He expressed confidence, even from his perch 725 miles away, about his peers in Gaza, the West Bank, and the Palestinian diaspora. I do believe in the power of young Palestinians to bring about change. They are taking matters into their own hands. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco, Snoop Dogg, the rapper and business mogul, on smoking weed, coaching peewee football, and performing at this year's Super Bowl. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Everybody around me is happy, my spirit is right, and just nothing but peace and tranquility in the building. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? You dig? Where would you like to live? Wakanda. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My wife and my kids. Shantae has been by my side since before I was Snoop. I was rapping to get her feedback on my songs before anyone would listen. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Cassius Clay, also known as Muhammad Ali, the people's champ. What is your greatest extravagance? Old school cars. When and where are you the happiest? I am the happiest creating, whether I am in the studio recording my next song, on stage performing in front of my fans, on the football field coaching kids in my Snoop Youth Football League, or on set filming. What is your favorite occupation? Football coach. Which talent would you most like to have? To play the piano. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? Nothing. All my experiences, talents, wins, and L's make me who I am today. I am constantly evolving, learning, and working toward not just being great, but also staying true to who I have always been. Just a kid with a big dream from the LBC. What is your greatest fear? Heights. I love being high, but I don't like being up high. What do you consider your greatest achievement? My business portfolio and my kids. I've been able to explore my many passions and interests. Making spirits with Indago Gin and 19 Crimes. Entering the fashion game with my G-Star denim line and Snoopy's clothing. Entering the metaverse with Sandbox and performing with Dr. Dre at the Super Bowl this year. What is your most treasured possession? The key to my mother's casket. A car, jewelry, or a house can't match that. That's the key to the queen. What do you most value in your friends? Work ethic. What is your most marked characteristic? Smoking weed. Who is your favorite hero? Bruce Lee. That man means the world to me. He was the first guy that I wanted to be like. He was little, he was calm, and he could kick a whole lot of ass. What is your greatest regret? There ain't no two Snoop Dogs, and I ain't got no twin brother, so he could do half this work that I'm doing. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? An angel. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Snoop Dogg. becoming the renowned writer, culture critic, and scholar of the demi-monde Lucy Sante on Finding Herself, with photographs by Ryan McGinley. Opening photo, A New Dawn, Lucy Sante beside the Hudson River in Ulster County, New York. On February 15th, 2021, I downloaded the application called FaceApp to my phone, just for a laugh. I'd had a new phone for a few months, and I was curious. Although the app allowed users to change age, shape, or hairstyle, I was, specifically and exclusively, interested in the gender swap function. I fed in a mugshot-style selfie, and in return got something that didn't displease me, a picture of an attractive woman in whose face my features were discernible. Changing genders was a strange and electric idea that had lived somewhere in the recesses of my mind for the better part of my 67 years. But I had seldom allowed myself such a graphic self-depiction. Over the years, I had occasionally drawn pictures and altered photographs to visualize myself as a woman, but had always immediately destroyed the results. And yet, I didn't delete that cyber image. Instead, over the next week or so, I hunted down and fed in every image of myself I possessed, beginning at about age 12. Snapshots, ID card pictures, studio portraits, book jacket photos, social media pictures. The effect was seismic. I could now see, laid out before me on my screen, the panorama of my life as a girl, from giggling preteen to last year's matron. I had always hated seeing pictures of myself, but these made every kind of sense. My desire to live as a woman, I could now see, was a coherent phenomenon, consistently just under the surface of my nominal life for all those decades, despite my best efforts to pretend it wasn't there. After that, something took over, a wave of pure momentum that persists even now, on good days, overriding my always crippling self-consciousness. Whatever that force might be, very likely the tectonic power of something long confined that is suddenly released, it converted insight into imperative. My cover with myself had been blown, and I had no choice but to take action. The last 2 weeks of February are a blur in my mind because so much was going on inside me that I couldn't keep track. I was about to make a radical break with my previous existence, but I have no way to reconstruct just how I proceeded to its execution. All I can remember for sure is driving 300 miles from my home in Ulster County, New York, to Utica and back for my first COVID vaccine. Appointments were hard to find in those early days, trying all the while to decide whether to hit the mall in Albany in search of a wig store. Tired of the drive and a bit fearful, I went straight home, but I came out to my therapist the following day. Trembling but resolute, I told Dr. G at our weekly Zoom session that I had always wanted to be a woman and now felt it urgent that I take the necessary steps. Dr. G had consistently maintained an imperturbable, nothing human is alien to me equanimity, but I was nevertheless stunned by her quick and unsurprised assent. "It makes sense," she told me. "It sounds like a good idea." In the 4 or 5 years I'd been seeing her, I had never broached any mention of gender. My inner omerta relegated all such thoughts to the deepest, darkest corners, guarded by dragons. I'd seen therapists for nearly 40 years by then, but only one previous practitioner had ever come close to breaking the silence. Around 1991, Dr. P. got me to admit that I had tried on my mother's dresses and undergarments in early adolescence, although we never got a chance to explore the ramifications. Not long after I made that admission, Dr. P died of a massive heart attack 20 minutes after I left his office. My relationships with therapists had been checkered before and after. One tried to convert me to New Age spirituality. One spent most sessions talking about herself. One admitted that her expertise was in child psychology, and I never fully trusted another until I began seeing Dr. G. In trans circles, a transgender person who is not yet fully aware of their nature is called an egg. When the moment of revelation occurs, the egg is said to crack. Subject to individual temperaments, cultural and environmental pressures, and any number of mysterious X factors, that can happen at any time. It is often said that while all trans stories are individual, all of them are the same. The order of those two phrases can be reversed. While the shape of the arc is generally consistent, some people are aware that they are trans from earliest childhood. Some realize it at puberty, and others only tumble to the truth much later in life. After that, the egg can crack immediately, or it can take years, or, as in my case, decades. One day in the fall of 1965, when I was 11, I was sitting in the kitchen of our tract house in New Jersey, waiting to be picked up by a friend's father. We had recently moved, and my friends were all now 5 miles away. For some reason, there was a mirror on the table, and I picked it up and looked at myself. I wore my hair in a modified bowl cut, which needed a trim just then. I gathered the longish loose strands above my temples and bent them into spit curls, wetting them so they'd hold their shape, and brushed down my bangs. I widened my eyes and softened my mouth. I looked just like a girl. Then I heard a footstep upstairs and quickly messed up my hair again. That was the first time I played with my appearance in that way, although thinking of myself as a girl had already been an intermittent preoccupation that I fought hard against. In the following years, the thoughts became more constant. On those rare occasions when my parents left me alone in the house, I was an only child and overprotected. I experimented with my mother's clothes and undergarments. I didn't leave them on for long, though, because I thought my mother would be able to detect my body odor once puberty set in. She was vigilant about keeping me on the straight and narrow, and as my adolescence went on, she would subject my room to regular sweeps, with no drawer or cubbyhole neglected, and no text, printed or handwritten, unscanned. She was looking for what exactly? Porn? Drugs? Atheism? In any case, it had the effect of making me hyper-vigilant. I learned to never write anything down that was private. I have never kept a diary, and to subject every piece of printed matter I might be tempted to take home to a rigorous shakedown, leaving on trains or park benches most of the underground newspapers I eagerly consumed. I was then beginning to take an interest in research, and so began gingerly to research my condition. My sources were meager, but then the culture was meager in turn. Transgender people were punchlines, figures of fun. The image was of someone in a shapeless polka dot dress with a bad wig and stubble. I followed French pop music, enough to know Jacques Dutronc, Il est 5 o'clock in the morning is when the transvestites, les travestis, go home to shave. At my all-boys Jesuit high school, I leafed through yearbooks from the 1920s and 30s in search of photos of students playing female roles on stage, which had ceased to be the custom. I knew a bit about Christine Jorgensen, the transgender pioneer of the 1950s, and she at least looked and acted like a woman, but in my view at the time, hardly anyone else did. What did it mean to be transsexual, a term that was in popular use at the time? It appeared to entail traveling to Bangkok or Casablanca and getting one's downstairs business excised. The thought hurt, and I avoided it. A few years later, when I was 20, I was walking around Malmo, Sweden, late at night. I passed a porn shop, where, in the middle of a dense collage on the front door, I spotted a photograph of a pretty young girl with a penis. How could that be? What could that mean? I was shaken. I plundered the library for materials which were scant. I read Croft Ebbing's bloodless classifications and endless sexological tomes that typically accorded half a page to transvestism, with diagnoses ranging from neurotic affliction to permissible as an occasional bedroom kink. But was I a transvestite? I did love women's clothes, and I loved wearing them on the rare occasions when they fell into my lap. A red floral blouse left behind in an East Village apartment I moved into, a whole pile of laundry abandoned atop a dryer in student lodgings at the University of Geneva, until I expunged them rapidly. To me, back then, there was something sordid about transvestism, something not genuine. As it was, I prevented myself from taking any further action. I couldn't shop or even browse at certain Manhattan haunts, such as Lee's Mardi Gras Boutique, or visit the Edelweiss or Club 82, or later spend time at the Pyramid Club, even though at one point it was less than half a block from my apartment. Anyway, however much I could appreciate drag culture from the outside, it wasn't my jam. I wanted to be a woman, not a satire. I was uninterested in big hair or big tits or high heels, and I hated the thought of being gaped at by men. At least, that was reason number one. Number two was that I was terrified of the power of my wish. I was mortally afraid of the very process I am now undergoing, although I also knew too little about it to be able to judge. When I was in single digits, I used to imagine being transformed into a girl overnight. Some nights I would yearn for it. On the others, I shook with fear at the prospect. It was too desirable, but too unobtainable. I could never really be a woman, so I had to resign myself and keep the thoughts from overwhelming me. Not until the internet came along, bringing with it a range of transgender sites, did I know much of anything about hormones. Now and then I talk with Jay, a friend of more than 40 years, who transitioned 2 or 3 years before me. We compare notes, and although our backgrounds and personalities are very different, our trans histories are hilariously similar. We laugh at the fact that as children, we both thought we were the only humans on the planet who had ever wanted to switch genders. But that was our time, so different from the present. My parents have now been dead for 20 years, but I cannot bear to imagine their reactions. Although I was an only child, I had an older sibling, stillborn, a year and a month before my birth. My parents named her Marie-Luce and bought her a 10-year grave. In land poor Belgium, graves are leased. I gathered that my mother had suffered miscarriages previously. In any case, the doctors gave her cautious approval to try pregnancy once more, but only once. When I was baptized, my parents inverted my sister's name and added a few more saints in gratitude. My mother's depression lasted the entire time I knew her, so I don't know for sure when it began. Her family life was unhappy, but she certainly presented cheerfully enough in snapshots from her post-war 20s. Her smile was never as genuine after that time. For one thing, the vexed process of childbirth clearly took a heavy toll on her. She seems to have mixed up Marie-Luce and me, or at least I got used to being called ma fifille or ma chute, because mon chou is masculine. She had to invent a feminine form. Although in areas of Europe, pink had long been for boys and blue for girls, my mother bucked convention, dressing me with blue in honor of the Virgin Mary. I was effectively sexless as a child, drawing and reading and playing with my large family of stuffed animals, to whom I assigned family positions. My mother and I were very close then, twice traveling back from New Jersey to Belgium, and living for months without my father while she settled affairs and debated moving back. But when puberty brought along secondary sexual characteristics, everything turned. From some time around then until I left home at 18, my mother hit me every day, usually a backhand across the dinner table. She also twice underwent electroshock therapy, after which she'd suffer temporary memory loss and mistake me for her brother. No one knows the causes of gender dysphoria. Only limited scientific research has been done on that or other transgender matters. What we know about the immediate and long-term effects of hormone replacement therapy remains largely folkloric, because there is so little funding for it. In many cultures, including our own, transgender people are situated at the very bottom of humanity, the unthinkable. We are lepers, and if we are vulnerable, we are preyed upon and often killed. Unsurprisingly, the mob mentality that drives such superstition is present within us transgender people also. Before my egg cracked, I kept up my surreptitious interest in transgender matters, watching YouTube videos and scrolling through endless photos of Japanese otokonoko models. Even so, I was distinctly uneasy when I was confronted with the actuality of transitioning genders, especially involving people bearing some sociological resemblance to me, such as Chelsea Manning or the Wachowski sisters. It seemed like they'd just gone too far. They'd never be able to get back to land. But such was the depth of my denial. For more than 55 years, I lived in a state of denial that kept my gender quandary suspended, as if pickled in a jar. I passed through periods of indulgence, when I would give in and daydream. I had a range of stock fantasies that I rotated and embroidered upon, cast as a girl in the school play, then persuaded to go out on the town in costume, hired as an assistant by a wealthy society woman who amuses herself by dressing me up as a girl. New roommate assigned to me in college has been dressing as a girl for years and has a full wardrobe. But they were transvestite fantasies, to my thinking, ultimately sterile. Then I would have periods of repudiation, when I would banish any such thoughts and diagnose my situation as a fetish, an unhealthy ideation, a neurosis that I imagined might be cured by a good relationship with a strong woman who would fully bring out the man in me. In both of these states, I kept my assorted gender questions and fixations scattered around different regions of my consciousness, refusing to accord them coherence. Thoughts about appearance went over here. My various failures to fulfill a male role went over there. The more existential questions were thrown on a shelf. After my egg cracked, I rode what trans and AA people call the pink cloud for a solid 3 months. That roseate mass of suspended water drops, which I was constantly warned about trusting too much, turned out to consist largely of the momentum I'm still riding, along with an evangelical faith in the process. For me, it also entailed a crash course in all sorts of things, from relearning how to move, to the history of transgender medicine, to developing firm opinions about collars, sleeve lengths, and silhouettes. Although I somehow managed to maintain my duties as an educator, teaching a college writing course during this period, my real occupation was transitioning. I could focus on little else. Very quickly, I joined a trans support group and consulted an endocrinologist. I started hormones on May 10th, and they caused me to crash off my cloud, although that didn't last long. I once described myself as a creature made entirely of doubt, much of it self-doubt. But as soon as I made up my mind to come out last February, I ceased doubting. That is to say, I experienced regular bouts of dysphoria, which in this context means intense recurring periods of self-doubt, self-hatred, and despair, which happen irregularly for varying lengths of time, typically, for me by now, about 2 or 3 days a week. Yet paradoxically, I had never before experienced such wholehearted conviction. Even in the throes of those bouts, I felt an unaccountable bedrock of certainty. My road to Damascus moment was cataclysmic in its effect. "This cracks open the world," I wrote on an index card, breaking my custom of not writing such things down. "I'm so relieved." Unfortunately, it happened 14 years into the best and most fulfilling relationship I'd ever enjoyed. I'd met M just as my marriage was reaching its breaking point, and she'd been my anchor ever since, my best friend, my co-pilot, my stern editor, my heart. Things were not always entirely smooth between us, but we just spent a happy year locked down together. Why did it have to happen then? Why couldn't it have happened after the collapse of my first significant relationship, around 1980, when I was certain I'd never find anyone else again? Or 10 years later, after the demise of my first marriage? Made on the rebound, which eventually revealed itself to have been unsuitable for both parties. Did it, as some of my friends wondered, have anything to do with the enforced seclusion and introspection of the COVID era? That wasn't so far from the seclusion and introspection in which I normally dwelt. But was it perhaps that I finally felt safe enough? In those days, I was spending unreasonable amounts of time taking selfies and gender-swapping them on the app. I had just gotten back one that I thought looked plausibly enough like me as a woman that I could show it to everyone and they would immediately understand. Note, I can no longer see the resemblance. That was the tack I decided to try with M. She'd think it was cute. Maybe that would soften the shock. The day after my session with Dr. G, I pulled it out after dinner. She was confused. What was I showing her? Well, it's me as a woman. Huh? I explained. She didn't see the resemblance, but she listened. I told her about my dark secret and how I had kept it hidden for upwards of 55 years and how it had suddenly come bursting out of my chest like the alien in Alien. She was taken aback, but she was moved. She offered support and encouragement. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.